Alvin Laudermilk's buckboard arrived a couple of hundred yards ahead of the others. Alvin stood up to wave before Julio Valdez reined the team to a nervous halt. The mules, young and of Spanish lineage, were as green as the pear cotton had been breaking. As soon as the Laudermilk mule team had the bronc worn off, they were for sale. Life was too short, Alvin contended, to let it be dull.
Get down, Alvin. I'm afraid you missed dinner.
Alvin lifted a bottle from under the seat.
I brought dinner.
Julio waited dutifully until his boss was through with the greetings.
Hello, Huey. Cotton.
He climbed down with the reins in his hand and began unhitching the team. Cotton hurried to help him with the buckles, snaps, and straps.
When you going to buy an automobile, Alvin?
When windmills start pumping gasoline. You can run a mule on grass and water, but them automobiles has got to be fed.
Alvin extended the bottle toward Huey. Huey was tempted, but it wouldn't be seemly in front of Cotton. Besides, Tommy was coming yonder with the rest of the horsemen and wagons.
Sun's too high, Alvin. Ask me again when we've raised the mill. Maybe we can bust a bottle against the tower to christen it like.
An empty bottle, Huey.
Alvin stood rock steady. Whatever little he might have drunk on the way hadn't affected him. Julio Valdez surveyed the standing pipe with the pride of vested interest.
The water is where I said. It is a strong well, I'll bet.
I don't know if the water's sweet.
Alvin Laudermilk walked around the windmill, silently surveying and approving the work.
Good job. Cotton done it, I suppose.
A wrench and a saw don't fit the shape of my hands.
Nothing fits your hands but a rope and a set of reins. You interested in a job, Huey?
Huey pondered a moment, looking off in the direction where the sheriff had gone.
Well, I kind of doubt I'll be staying long.
He saw Cotton glance questioningly at him.
I'm expecting word on a job out in the Big Bend country. Not no 30-a-month cow-punching job, but a foreman's job.
Alvin seemed to see through him, at least part way. Huey had never wanted a foreman's job in his life. Too much responsibility went with it.
I always got some broncs that need breaking. That's a job that fits your hands. You can come over to my place and stay, or you can bring him over here to Walter's. Either way, you got a job anytime you want it.
Much obliged, Alvin. I'll study on it.
Uncle Huey, don't you think you're getting to an age where you ought to quit riding those rough broncs?
When a man has sitting down work, he better hang on to it.
Tommy loped up ahead of the rest and slid his pony to a reckless cowboy stop. He wore his working clothes, though he had a church clean look about him. He also had a boy's eagerness.
Howdy, Uncle Huey. Bet it didn't take Cotton long to finish up with you to help him.
Huey didn't look at the post hole diggers.
We each taken the jobs that fitted us best.
Walter Calloway rode up on one of his working mules. His farmer overalls presented a picture Huey could never quite adjust to. Walter dismounted in a businesslike manner and surveyed the prone mill with a critical eye, looking for flaws. He found none.
You done real good, son.
Walter turned to Huey.
Thanks for helping.
I've done my best.
Storekeeper Pearson Phelps climbed carefully down from his wagon and exercised his cramped legs, then moved toward Huey with both hands outstretched. His grin was broader than a double tree. He was on the gray side of 60. His heavy shoulders were bent from a lifetime of heavy lifting and carrying the weight of a mortgage. But his ample belly showed he'd always taken home plenty of groceries out of stock.
I declare, Huey Calloway, it's good to see you again. How come you haven't been to town to visit with us?
Huey took several steps to meet the merchant halfway.
Well, it didn't get in till yesterday. Besides, I didn't bring much in the way of coin. Didn't figure my welcome would be too good.
If paying customers were the only people who ever came in, that little town would get awfully lonesome.
For what it was worth, Pearson Phelps was the leading businessman in Upton City. Not necessarily a great feat, in view of the fact that there were so few. Last time Huey passed through town, he counted 8, including the Mexican wood and water hauler. Trailing quietly in Phelps's bulky shadow was a slightly smaller man named Schneider. He materialized a few years ago from some unpronounceable place down in the German-speaking Texas Hill Country. Schneider was considered something of an oddity, the only person of the Dutch persuasion in Upton City. He was known to read Shakespeare and Goethe and Zola, the last two some kind of foreign radicals. But he was nevertheless generally considered of a bit less than average intelligence because he spoke with an accent and sometimes got his words out of the customary order. The community regarded the man as somewhat below the established social level, such as it was, because he ran a small saloon for Pearson Phelps. The taint somehow never attached itself to Phelps, though he owned the place. Phelps conducted the saloon business separately from his general store and was rarely seen to enter its door except at closing time to count the day's receipts. By then, all decent women were well inside their own doors so that they never saw him. It was the women who established local social standards. Pearson never poured the whiskey. Schneider did that, so it was Schneider who bore the stigma. He had long since resigned himself to the lofty, throat-cutting stares of the womenfolk.
That horrid Dutchman.
Huey doubted Eve even knew his name.
Howdy, Dutch. You bring any samples?
It is the Sabbath.
Schneider always sat on the back row of the church, alone, keeping his own counsel and making his own treaties with the Lord. It was whispered around town that he was actually a Lutheran, which was probably about as bad as being a Catholic. But perhaps the preacher could yet save him. It was said of Schneider that no one was ever allowed to get drunk in his saloon if he had a family. Nor could a family man buy more than one bottle at a time if Schneider suspected he might empty them all in one place. Alvin Laudermill was a special case. He dealt directly with Pearson Phelps, wholesale. In another wagon sat a homesteader whose name Huey vaguely remembered as Neely. Or maybe it was Needy. He always showed up to borrow something. Needy was probably right, Huey reflected. The farmer's son sat beside him, a boy about Tommy's age. Lester was his name. He looked like a Lester, Huey thought. That rhymed with Nestor, appropriate all round. A couple of C.C. Tarpley's cowboys from the South Camp rounded out the group. They followed on horseback behind the wagons. Cece might not take kindly if he saw them here. He probably wouldn't say anything. He'd just cut their wages the next payday and plead hard times. Where possible, he favored a style of punishment that yielded a profit. It stood to reason that some of these people brought their womenfolk. They'd be at the house with Eve, helping her fix a big supper. The boy's black dog trotted behind the last wagon, tongue out. He'd probably started following this unaccustomed caravan with enthusiasm, but the enthusiasm was long since gone. He slowed to a painful walk, sought the shade of the nearest wagon, and flopped down, panting. A jackrabbit could have walked up and kicked him on the nose for all he cared. The howdying and shaking hands didn't take long. Everybody seemed agreed that the sooner they finished the work, the sooner they could start the pleasure. Raising the tower wasn't difficult. Huey was still confident that he and Cotton could have done it. In its way, it was probably one of the easiest parts of the operation. Walter Calloway didn't trust the bronc mules. He borrowed Pearson Phelps' gentle team for the task. Huey mounted Tommy's horse. He and the two Tarpley cowboys each tied an anchor rope to the tower and rode off at angles, keeping their ropes taut so the tower couldn't tip to one side or the other as the team raised it. A cross brace was chained between the two tower legs that rested on the ground, and it was butted against the upright posts that Huey had placed. This would keep the tower from sliding instead of coming up. As the Phelps team pulled and the mill gained slowly in angle and height, the lift became easier. The anchormen moved with the tower, keeping their ropes tight. In only a minute or so, the two forward legs set themselves on the ground. Cotton and Walter, using steel crowbars, inched the tower one way and the other until a plumb bob showed it was centered squarely over the well and the pipe.
That's it, Daddy!
The ropes were firmly staked to guard against a sudden strong wind pushing the tower over. Cotton took it upon himself to be sure the tower was level. He prized and shimmed under each leg until the plumb bob and the spirit level showed the mill was in perfect alignment with the hole. The men set in to digging anchor post holes by each of the four legs. That took a while. Huey deferred to his blisters so long as there were plenty of other volunteers. When the holes were finished, Cotton tied an anchor post snugly against each tower leg with wire so it wouldn't slip, then began drilling holes with an auger. He drove a heavy bolt through each hole as soon as he finished it. While Cotton went about drilling other holes, Huey tightened a nut over each bolt, firmly securing the tower legs to the anchor posts. Walter turned to Tommy.
You can fill in with dry sand now and tamp the holes real good.
Dry sand, properly pounded, would grip and hold tighter and longer than cement. Huey noticed that the Nestor boy, Lester, was adept at making the motions, but contributing little muscle to the job. He would move as if to take hold, but do it slowly so somebody else was always likely to get on it ahead of him and relieve him of the necessity. He looked eager enough that he got credit for trying without ever actually breaking a sweat. He grunted a lot.
Given a decent start, he probably has a future ahead of him in politics.
By contrast, Cotton did his work so smoothly that it seemed to involve little stress. People like that seldom received much credit. They never grunted enough. They could not grasp the importance of showmanship. After a while, the anchor posts were well tamped and the tower was considered solid. Huey helped lower the cylinder and the sucker rods down the pipe, joined at a time. In a while, the top sucker rod and the red rod were bolted together. This was the moment of supreme test. Cotton glanced at his father, and Walter nodded. Cotton released the lever that held the wheel and the tail locked together. Freed, the tail swung out at a right angle and pulled the wheel into the soft south wind. For a moment, the gears groaned as the big wooden fan strained off its lethargy and slowly began to turn. The sucker rod began to stroke up and down. Huey took off his hat and knelt with his ear against the pipe. In a minute, he could hear the water working its way higher with each stroke. Then it began gushing out the end of the flow pipe. It was muddy at first, clearing the accumulation which had silted into the bottom since the well had been drilled. In a little while, the water cleared. Everybody stood around in silence, watching it gush with each stroke of the rod. They seemed fascinated by the sight. No matter how many times they'd seen it, there was always a vague feeling of a miracle beheld in this dry land. Cotton walked to the end of the pipe, cupped his hand, and cautiously took a tentative sip. He blinked, as if only half believing, then took another drink, a larger one.
It's sweet!
Julio smiled. One by one, men and boys filed by to take a swallow or two. Presently, Julio was the only one who would not. The little man's teeth gleamed.
I do not have to drink the water. The witching rod has told me how it tastes.
Walter signaled for Tommy to shut off the mill.
No use wasting the water and making a loblolly. You gotta take time somehow to get over here with a team in Fresno and scoop out a surface tank.
Huey heard himself volunteering before he'd adequately considered the ramifications of the job.
I'll start tomorrow.
Cotton glanced worriedly at him.
It won't take but a few days, Budden.
He thought about it a little more. If a shovel or a set of post hole diggers didn't fit his hands, the heavy iron handle of a mule-drawn Fresno dirt mover was no better. He already had blisters enough, but he never considered backing out once the commitment was made. Greasy and muddy, the men stood around admiring the results of the afternoon's work with all the self-righteousness that comes from knowing a job has been properly attacked and competently mastered. The Nestor boy looked especially tired, especially self-righteous.
Cotton, Tommy, load up the tools in the wagon.
Lester Needy trailed along behind, picking up the lighter pieces. His father had told him to be careful of his back. A growing boy shouldn't overdo. Alvin Laudermilk, gloriously greasy and muddy, brought a bottle from under the seat of his buckboard. Its original contents had already been considerably depleted.
Here's to a good day's work!
Huh? All the men drank as the bottle came around, except Schneider. Nobody in Upton City could remember ever seeing him drink anything but coffee. When the bottle had made the rounds, Alvin took a swig from it. A little whiskey remained in the bottom.
Every windmill's got to have a name. Walter, name this one and we'll christen it proper.
I hadn't even thought about it.
Alvin turned to Huey.
Well, then I'll name it. In honor of the prodigal brother, come home to help eat the unfatted calf. From now on, this is Huey's mill.
Cotton done all the work. It all by rights to be named after him.
But nobody seemed to hear him, least of all Cotton, who frowned darkly and went on with loading up the tools. Alvin smashed the bottle against a corner post, a remnant of whiskey running down the clinging shreds of cedar bark.
I bet you never had anything named after you before.
Huey wondered at Alvin's extravagance with good whiskey.
Once, a horse. We never did manage to get him broke proper.
Well, people can see a windmill a long ways farther than they can see a horse. And every time they look at this one, they're gonna think of you.
Huey looked up at the rejuvenated wheel, a motley mixture of old wood and new.
I wish it was painted then.
Cotton fetched a shovel back out of the wagon and dug a little hole against the corner post and raked the broken glass into it and covered it up. It would be like some nosy calf to find that glass before the sun went down. Cotton gave Huey a quick, exasperated glance, as if he counted him responsible for Alvin's exuberance. The crew trailed out south toward the house. Alvin motioned for Huey to come up beside him in the buckboard. Julio climbed into Cotton's wagon, which seemed to suit Cotton better than riding with his uncle. The black dog got under Cotton's wagon and trotted along just fast enough to keep himself in the moving shade. Alvin wanted Huey to tell him about some of the wonders he'd encountered in his travels. Huey accommodated him, loose-herding the truth a little bit, but not so much that he wouldn't get away with it. Tommy rode alongside, listening eagerly. As they neared the house and the tall chinaberry trees, a reddish dog came trotting out toward them, barking a challenge, but looking behind him every few seconds to see if help was coming. Tommy's dog took up the challenge and moved out from under Cotton's wagon into the sunshine. Both dogs took care not to carry the contest too close to each other. The red dog was on the small side, a fact that failed to arouse overconfidence in Tommy's.
He belongs to our teacher. I don't know why she had to come over here. We see enough of her on the other days without having to listen to her on Sunday, too.
Yeah, she's not much of a teacher, I suppose.
She knows a lot, but she ought to at her age.
She got a name?
Miss Renfro. Miss Spring Renfro.
Spring? That's an odd name.
Summer would probably fit her better. Late summer.
Huey smiled. He doubted that Tommy was a dependable judge of a woman's age. If she was over 25, though, she probably wasn't much to look at. In this country, where men outnumbered women like the Indians had outnumbered Custer, spinsterhood was a difficult state for a woman to hang on to unless she had a face that would stop a runaway horse in mid-stride. Even the plain schoolteachers tended to get married off with only a modest effort on their part, and the pretty ones seldom made it through the first school year. Huey never held much truck with school teachers, plain or pretty. They always made him nervously aware of how much he'd never learned, of how slowly he read and how painstakingly he wrote, and occasionally demanded that he write anything at all. He never could understand why teachers should seem so superior. He'd never seen a man teacher yet who could ride a bronc more than two good jumps. Any school kid could learn to read a book, but good bronc riders were few and thin on the ground. It took several minutes for the men to unsaddle the horses, unhitch the teams, and turn all the stock into a pen for a bait of oats. Tommy turned to Lester.
Let's me and you run to the house and see if we can freeze the ice cream.
Oh, turning the freezer always makes my arm tired.
But the ones who freeze it get to lick the dash. Come on.
Tommy hustled to the house, and Lester followed, but he stayed a couple of steps behind all the way. Walter started toward the house at a slower pace, followed by Pearson Phelps, the Dutchman, and the farmer Needy, the two Tarpley cowboys and Julio Valdez. Huey was about to follow, but Alvin grabbed his arm.
Them women folks can wait for us a few minutes.
He went to his buckboard, rummaged around, and came up with a bottle. He glanced toward the house and evidently decided he could be seen. He stuck it inside his shirt and headed for the little shed out beside the windmill. Safely behind it, he brought the bottle back out from its hiding place. Huey could see that the cork had never been removed.
I love the women folk, God bless them, but there are times when their talk could drive me to distraction without a little drop of kindness to smooth off the edges.
Alvin pulled the cork out and extended the bottle toward Huey. Huey reasoned that he'd be standing within smelling distance of Eve in a few minutes.
I believe I'll pass.
Alvin took a long swallow and paused to lick his lips and enjoy the flavor.
Oh, mmm. Whoa. Oh, I swear, Huey, that batch must have been blessed by the breath of an angel. You gotta try it.
He shoved the bottle into Huey's hand. Huey was sorely tempted, but he had made up his mind. He tried to push the bottle back at Alvin. A woman's voice cut like rusty barbed wire.
Mr. Laudermilk.
Huey knew he was in trouble even before he turned and gazed into the reproachful eyes of Cora Laudermilk. But she wasn't there alone. Beside her stood Eve Calloway, whose own eyes were like Indian flint. Beyond Eve stood a woman Huey'd never seen before, and beyond them all stood a man wearing a dust-tinted black suit with frayed cuffs and a top button gone. He was Brother Averill, the Baptist preacher who hammered at the gates of hell every Sunday morning from 10 to 11, and occasionally longer when the spirit was really upon him. Alvin got hold of his wits first.
Why, howdy, Cora! Huey was just offering me a drink to celebrate his homecoming. I was telling him how it wouldn't be proper on the Sabbath afternoon.
Huey would cheerfully have stomped Alvin with a pair of hobnailed boots if he'd owned any. Cora Laudermilk swung those narrowed eyes on Huey and skewered him with them.
Mr. Calloway.
It was her habit to use the word Mr. to her husband and other close acquaintances only when she was sorely provoked. Huey was acutely aware that he still held the guilty bottle in his unguilty hand. He thought to swing it behind him out of sight, but this was a futile gesture. Right now that bottle seemed bigger than a horse. He would have hurled it across the fence, but that would have called more attention to it. Eve didn't speak. She only stared at him, her face reddening beneath the cover of her big slat bonnet.
Perhaps Brother Huey forgot this was the Sabbath.
The third woman's face was impassive, but Huey thought he saw laughter in her eyes, struggling to escape imprisonment. She wouldn't think it was so damn funny if Eve was her sister-in-law, Huey thought, resentment touching him a little. He glanced back at Alvin Laudermilk. On that face was the innocence of a child picking wildflowers in a field, a soul untainted even by original sin.
Oh, by George, preacher, you're right. It is the Sabbath.
He held the bottle out at arm's length and turned it upside down. Alvin's innocence turned to pain as he watched the long stream of golden elixir soaking quickly into the sand. But he stood in silence and bore the sacrifice like a soldier.
In the future, Mr. Calloway, I hope you will remember not only the Sabbath, but also my husband's weakness.
I'll sure try to.
When the bottle was empty, Huey tossed it into the sand beside the shed. Cora took her husband's arm and led him away.
You have done the proper thing, Huey.
Huey watched the departing Alvin.
I'm sure I did, preacher.
The minister looked a moment at the stiff-shouldered Eve and spoke to the other woman.
Shall we go back to the house, Miss Renfro?
Miss Renfro still had that laugh in her eyes, though her face never changed expression. After she turned away, Huey couldn't remember what color the eyes had been. All he had seen was the laugh in them. Eve's hands were on her hips. This was May, but her eyes said October.
You're running true to form, Huey. Just home one day, and you've already embarrassed me in front of Brother Averill and the boy's teacher, not to mention Cora Laudermilk.
I expect Cora has seen a whiskey bottle a time or two before.
Not on this place. I trust this will be the last time such a thing ever happens.
I never had a drop, Eve. You can smell my breath if you have a mind to.
Not for a $10 gold piece.
Eve set off toward the house, trailing after the others. Huey slumped, flexing his hands, glancing once at the bottle lying by the shed, wishing he had taken a drink out of it, since he'd endured all the blame for it anyway. Seemed like sometimes he had two left feet. Cotton came out of the corral. Huey hadn't realized the boy was still out there, putting up the windmill tools. He wondered how much Cotton had heard or seen. Cotton said nothing. He walked to the shed, picked up the empty bottle, and carried it to a trash barrel behind the yard fence.
Hell.
Huey followed after the others. As was the custom, the men stayed outside, sitting in chairs or on the ground beneath the great rustling chinaberry trees. The women were in the house. Huey could hear and smell the chicken frying. On the front step sat Tommy, turning the handle of a wooden ice cream freezer. A wet burlap bag stuffed around the top held in the cold and extended the useful life of the expensive salt-packed ice, thoughtfully brought from town by Pearson Phelps. The boy Lester cranked slowly on a second freezer. Tommy had to remind him two or three times not to stop because the dash would freeze up. The boy's black dog and the teacher's red one still stalked one another with wary patience, neither allowing the other to get quite close enough for a bona fide acquaintanceship to begin. They traded a certain amount of tentative and shallow growling. They reminded Huey of his own relationship with Eve. Huey wanted to think of something else, so when Pearson Phelps began drawing him out on the details of his recent adventures, Huey obliged. He told of working his way up through the Indian Territory and of Homer Gans's horse race. He told of his attempt to break into the big and easy money of show business by trying to get on as a bronc rider with the 101 Ranch Wild West show.
They put me on for a tryout. I'm telling you, boys, these broncs we've got down in this country are rocking horses against them outlaws they gather up for that show. By the third day, I'd eaten so much dirt that I must have gained 15, 20 pounds. One of them throwed me for a belly buster that emptied all the air out of me plumb down to my toes. I drug myself up against a fence post and sat there trying to get some wind back into my lungs when old Zach Miller himself walked up. He says, "If you can't handle them rough ones, then you oughtn't to have hired out." He looks me up and down then, says, "The main trouble with you is that you've done et too many birthday cakes." I says, "Where I've spent most of my birthdays, there wasn't nobody around to bake me a cake." But I reckon we was both agreed that I wasn't no Showtime cowboy. It would have been easy money. I was told they paid some of them boys as much as $75, $80 a month, and they didn't have to ride but five or six broncs a day. I reckon I wasn't cut out for that kind of business anyway. When I do a job of work, I like to know there's something real going to come out of it. If I break a bronc, it's so somebody can use him in cow work. If I break a mule, it's so somebody can hitch him to a wagon and get some use out of him. But in those shows, they just ride for an audience, and when you're through, there has nothing been built, nothing real been gained. It's sort of like for nothing. Well, except for the money, of course.
The farmer Needy looked at Huey.
"You talk as if you don't think money's important."
It was a concept of which he obviously disapproved.
I never met anybody hardly who thought he had enough of it. Not even old C.C. Tarpley. Since there's no way you can ever get enough of it anyway, I don't see where a man ought to kill himself running after a hopeless cause. There's too many other things in life to please you.
There are a great many things in this life more important than pleasure.
If it don't please you, then it ain't worth your time.
Pleasure is in the next life. This life was meant to be lived in trial and suffering, to prepare us for the glory of the next.
You know, I've known a lot of folks who kept putting off enjoying themselves, figuring they'd get around to it one of these days. Then one morning they woke up and found they was old, and it was too late then.
Not if they had lived a Christian life. The real joy awaits us all in the next world.
I don't see no harm in practicing up for it a little while we're here.
Eve came out onto the step where the two boys had finished freezing the ice cream.
You men can come on in and fill your plates. Then you can come back outside where it's cooler.
Can Lester and me clean the dashes now? You promised.
You boys will have to wait. I don't want you spoiling your supper. Brother Averill, would you lead us in the blessing?
Huey stood up nervously, forgetting to remove his hat until he saw the other men doing it. It always seemed to him that the Lord must be awfully busy, and it must be an imposition to him to have to stop his work three times a day and listen to people all over the world telling him thank you. Surely he knew everybody was grateful without his having to hear him say it so often.
Heavenly Father, it behooves us on this Sabbath day, wherein we have engaged in labor for our friends in need, to pause now in thanksgiving for your many blessings. Blessings which you have bestowed upon the righteous families of the Calloways and the Laudermilks, and all the people
Brother
of this
Averill
community.
Brother Averill launched into
you
a lengthy blessing in which he named everybody here except Julio Valdez. Huey didn't know if he'd forgotten the Mexican, couldn't say his name, or simply considered the poor soul lost on account of his race. Huey began to feel he was going to get a crick in his neck from holding his head down so long, and he thought the prayer might run on for 10 more minutes. The breeze brought a strong whiff of fried chicken, which tantalized Huey almost to the point of sin. It might have reached the preacher, too, for he suddenly brought the long prayer to a snappy conclusion.
And now, Lord, we, thy unworthy servants, humbly ask thy blessings on this food of which we are fixing to partake. Amen.
Walter motioned for Brother Averill to lead the way into the house, a courtesy which the minister graciously accepted. His strictures against labor on the Sabbath did not extend to the frying of chicken. Huey hung back. So did Julio, accustomed to being last, and Alvin Laudermilk, who'd been casting uneasy glances at Huey ever since they'd seated themselves beneath the trees. At length, Alvin seemed to lose an inner battle. He came up to Huey with his head down.
Huey, I kind of left you hanging on the fence out yonder a while ago. I hope you won't take it ill of me.
Huey shrugged. His momentary resentment had evaporated long ago.
Who knows? If I was a married man, I might have done the same.
Well, it ain't that I was afraid of her. It's just that I like a peaceful house. You come on over and break some horses and mules for me a while, Huey, and you'll find out that Cora ain't a bad woman at all. It's just that it's a little easier to lie to her than it is to explain some things. You'll learn what I mean if you ever get married.
Yeah, I don't reckon I'll ever get married then, because I've never told a lie in all my life.
Brother Averill returned carrying a plate loaded with chicken, red beans, and biscuits. One by one, the other men came out.
We better go in, Huey. Women folk won't eat till we're all fed.
Not until Alvin and Huey went into the house did Julio trust himself to follow, the last of the men to go. Eve stood at the plain old wooden table, forking pieces of chicken onto everybody's plate. Huey expected her to give him a couple of necks and a back, but she gave him drumsticks. Her eyes weren't warm exactly, but the frost was gone. Cora was too busy fussing over her husband's welfare to pay any attention to Huey, which was just as well. Miss Renfro stood at the bread pan.
You look like a big biscuit eater to me, Mr. Calloway. How many do you want, 5 or 6?
She had some big biscuits.
Oh, 5's enough. I don't want to look like a hog.
She smiled. It was the first time he'd really looked at her. She wasn't a pretty woman. He supposed many people would consider her plain and somewhat skinny at that, but the smile was pleasant. While she wore it, in the dim light of the kitchen, she would almost pass for pretty. And he would bet she wasn't too far over 30. Well, not 40, anyway. He poured the coffee for himself. While he was at it, he poured one for Julio, too. Huey noticed that Eve had given Julio mostly chicken wings, but he was glad to see that Miss Renfro hadn't shorted him on biscuits. Julio did like biscuits, especially when he had plenty of syrup to sop them in. Huey reached up into a cabinet and brought down a bucket of molasses.
Here's a lick, Huey. Move them biscuits over and I'll pour some on your plate.
He took one of his drumsticks and exchanged it for one of Julio's wings.
Always a little partial to the wing.
After everyone had eaten, Eve let Tommy and Lester carry the freezers into the house. Soon they were back, each carrying a freezer dash standing in a bowl. They seated themselves on the step and eagerly went to work spooning off the ice cream that clung to the paddles. Down at the Chinaberry Grove, 2 sets of freight wagons had pulled up for the night. Presently, the teamsters came up leading their mule teams to water them at the house windmill.
Walter, you tell Blue Hannigan for them not to go fixing anything to eat. We've got a plenty left right here.
Walter walked out and invited the freighters to eat with the rest of the crowd, an invitation they accepted without hesitation or a false show of reluctance.
Tommy, Lester, that one's Blue Hannigan. He eats like one of his mules. We better get all the ice cream we want before he starts, because he sure won't leave any for us.
Tommy was chagrined. About that time, Huey's horse, Biscuit, came up to the corrals from the horse pasture where he was confined. Huey walked out to look at him to try and see if the lameness had improved any.
How you doing, fella? That foot any better?
Biscuit stood outside the closed gate, shut off from the feed and from the horses and mules that had put in the day at work. Huey opened the gate and let him in. Finding the troughs empty, he poured some oats for Biscuit, confident that the horse wouldn't let the others steal any of it. As Huey turned toward the house, he saw the schoolteacher walking toward him. She was a tall woman and thin, her plain gray dress almost sweeping the ground. In her hand, she held a coffee cup with a spoon sticking out of it.
You're about to miss the ice cream, Mr. Calloway. We ran out of bowls. I hope the cup will do.
Oh, you didn't have to bring it all the way out here to me, but I'm much obliged.
No trouble. I didn't want to see you miss out.
She handed him the cup. Awkwardly, he wondered if courtesy didn't indicate that he ought to give her the first bite, but there was only one spoon. Most people were a little squeamish about things like that, and he figured that as a schoolteacher, she surely would be.
Sure, thank you, Miss...
Somehow, her name had slipped away from him.
Renfro. Spring Renfro. I'm the boy's teacher.
Well, thank you, Miss Renfro.
He knew he shouldn't ask, but he did it anyway.
How'd you come to have a name like Spring?
I was born in April. My mother said it had been a long winter, and she was glad to see spring.
He looked at the sparkle in her eyes and decided the name fitted her.
Well, I'm pleased to meet you. I'm Huey Calloway.
She smiled, and again her plainness disappeared.
I want you to rest assured, Mr. Calloway, that I know where the bottle came from. I've come across many of Alvin Laudermilk's hiding places.
The country schoolhouse stood at the Laudermilk Ranch headquarters. Other teachers had stayed at the same place in years past. Cora Laudermilk, who had lost one child in infancy and had never been able to have another, seemed to enjoy the company. It was also good to have someone extra around to help see after her semi-invalid old mother, whose legs were slow but whose sharp tongue was swift.
Good folks, the Laudermilks. Good place they've got.
It was an empty statement, but she flustered him a little, like schoolteachers usually did. He didn't want to say too much because he knew his grammar bespoke more of the barn than of the schoolhouse.
Hope the ice cream is good.
Oh, fine. Just fine.
He sensed that she was giving him an opportunity to initiate a conversation, and he was doing a damn poor job of it.
You come from back east, I suppose?
Not very far east. Just East Texas.
Well, we was born in East Texas, too. Me and Walter. Been a long time since we left. He was probably no more than a little girl.
It struck him too late that he was making a judgment about her age. A judgment one didn't make about strange women, or even those one knew well. She seemed to take no offense.
It has been a while since I was a little girl.
Yes, and what the hell else am I supposed to say?
The sound of a vehicle approaching from beyond the barn saved him from the necessity of saying anything.
Pardon me, Miss Renfro.
Huey stepped out to the side where he could see better. It was unusual for company to come from that direction, that of the French place, where he spent the better part of the day helping put up the windmill. Huey squinted. He made out that this was a buggy drawn by a pair of grays.
That will be Mr. C.C. Tarpley. And I suppose the gentleman with him will be Mr. Frank Gervin.
Huey noted the tone of her voice.
We call him fat. There are some who wouldn't call him a gentleman.
Including myself.
She started in a brisk walk back toward the house, seeming not to want to be outside when the buggy arrived. Huey walked slower, eating the ice cream and watching her. For an old maid school teacher, she seemed to have a right smart of judgment. The fact that she didn't like Fat Gervin was proof of that. His smooth manners around the womenfolk were reported to have fooled some of them a while. All the men were standing up by the time C.C. Tarpley brought the buggy to a stop. A testament to the respect, if not liking, people felt for the rapacious old cowman. They hadn't stood up for Fat Gervin's sake, Huey reflected. Walter stepped forward and extended his hand.
Howdy, Mr. Tarpley. Get down, get down.
Back in the days when Walter had been working for him, it had always been C.C., not Mr. Tarpley. That, Huey decided, was the difference between simply working for a man and borrowing money from him.
Just passing, Walter. Heard y'all was putting up a windmill on the French place. Came by and found you'd already finished.
I had plenty of help.
Walter waved his hand toward the other visitors. Huey noted that the two Tarpley cowboys had somehow melted out of sight, probably behind the house. It wouldn't do them any good. Huey would bet a dollar to a plug nickel that the sharp-eyed old man had already spotted their horses in the corral. He wasn't one to miss anything. Eve Calloway opened the screen door and moved out onto the step.
Mr. Tarpley, we've still got plenty left to eat. You and Mr. Gervin get down and come on in.
Fat Gervin looked hopefully at his father-in-law.
Eve, we sure do appreciate the invitation, but we ain't hardly got the time.
And then he spotted the ice cream freezers by the step.
You still got some ice cream, too?
We certainly do.
Tommy's face fell. He'd counted on getting to clean out the last of it.
Then I reckon we'll just take time.
His decision was clearly popular with his son-in-law, who could sometimes move with surprising swiftness for a man of his bulk. The buggy seat seemed to rise 3 inches on its springs when Gervin stepped down. Huey frowned as he watched Fat. He'd never been able to trust a man who had slick hands and wore a coat in the summertime. While Cece and Fat were in the house, the two Tarpley cowboys quickly said their goodbyes and beat a hasty retreat to the barn. They rode off in a northerly direction where they could not be seen, though the camp where they lived was in the opposite direction. They would get there. It would just take longer this way. The crowd had fallen silent. It was odd, Huey thought, how deadening an effect one rich old man could have on a conversation.
Why, it's no wonder we have to be so careful with lending nowadays. The national economy is in a precarious position.
Fat Gervin, between bites, set up a one-sided dialogue that was more lecture than conversation, all about the state of the nation's economy and the alarming growth of the national debt, and such as that. Huey surmised that he was spending a lot of time in Tarpley's bank lately and reading banker publications. 5 years ago, Fat couldn't account at a herd of cattle, much less figure up the national debt. Tommy's worst fears materialized. Eve scraped the very last of the ice cream out for Cece and Fat. The old rancher sat in the chair Walter had vacated for him and ate with gusto, while Fat continued a long discourse on the struggle between management and labor.
In my day, I've seen a lot of changes come over this country, and I've been opposed to almost every one of them. But one thing I was never opposed to was ice cream. This is bully stuff, Eve. Bully stuff.
Glad you like it, Mr. Tarpley. We'd freeze some more, but there isn't enough ice. Mr. Phelps was kind enough to bring us what he had.
Cece looked toward the storekeeper.
I'm told there are people who are actually buying ice to put it in their drinking water, Pearson. Is that true? Dangerous thing getting people accustomed to luxury like that. One luxury leads to another, and pretty soon they'll get to thinking they ought to have ice water every Sunday, maybe even during the week. Get people spoiled the luxury, and pretty soon it's not a luxury anymore, it's a necessity. It's a terrible waste of this country's resources. There ought to be a law passed right now to stop it. But there ought never be any law against ice cream.
Eve picked up the bowl when Tarpley was through with it, and she waited for Gervin to finish his. Cece Tarpley stood up. Fat, always watching him for his cues, did likewise. Old Tarpley looked around a little, taking in the house, the barn, the fences, and general improvements.
You've done right smart with this place, Walter.
We've done the best we could.
The old man frowned.
That windmill you put up today. I looked through the bank records and I couldn't find where you had borrowed any money from us to pay for it.
It wasn't a new mill, Mr. Tarpley.
It still cost money, even for an old one. You got to drill the hole, and I could tell there was some new lumber and fixings went into the mill. Just about everything you got is mortgaged to our bank. I was just kind of curious where you got the money, Walter.
Huey frowned at the implication.
My boy Cotton helped old man Maxie drill the well. In return for the old man's time and the use of his machinery, my boy's going to give him 3 weeks labor when school's out. I haven't mortgaged my boy's labor.
Yeah, there's still the mill. How'd you pay for the mill?
It was a damaged one that had fallen over south of Midland. It didn't cost me much. Back when it's still too early to plant, I throwed my team and wagon in with Blue's freighting outfit hauling lumber from the railroad in Midland. 4 loads earned me enough to buy the windmill and the lumber it took to patch it up.
That seemed to set Cece's mind at ease, but it simply launched Fat Gervin on another harangue. As an understudy to the old man, he was trying hard to acquire Cece's inborn meanness with a dollar.
You know, Walter, our bank has got a mortgage on that wagon and team. What if something had happened to them while you was working on that job? And what about the unusual wear and tear? The man is borrowing. He owes it to the institution to take good care of his collateral and see that it ain't no way impaired or demeaned.
Tarpley nodded in surprised silence, noting with some pleasure that his hard-taught lessons might be starting to take root.
You know the importance.
Fat got started on how great and indispensable an institution the bank had been in the development of the nation, and how everybody owed it to his country as a patriotic duty to stand four square with the bank at all times. Occasionally, when Huey was in a mood of philosophical generosity, he would rationalize Fat's shortcomings and tell himself Fat wasn't altogether to blame. Maybe Huey and a lot of others like him were at fault, too. Cowboys could be merciless in hoo-rawing the misfit, the inept, the unwilling. He would tell himself that they probably drove Fat inward with their ridicule, making him sullen and mean. But Huey's spasms of nobility usually dissipated quickly, and he'd recover his standing conviction that sons of bitches are born, not made. He had heard enough about banks in the last 10 minutes to satisfy whatever curiosity might arise in him for the next 3 or 4 years. He moved away from the crowd, looking toward the barn and thinking he probably ought to go run Biscuit back into the horse pasture. He noticed the teacher's red dog making his way from one bush, one weed, to another, pausing briefly at certain ones to raise a leg and leave his signature. The boy's black dog followed at a respectful distance, sniffing at each such imprint and endorsing it. Huey looked over his shoulder toward Fat. The devil began to jab sinfully but deliciously at him. Fat's back was turned, and his jaw was still operating at a hearty pace. Huey looked toward the house to make sure none of the women were outside to witness his surrender to temptation. They wouldn't understand. No properly modest woman knew much about male bodily functions, be they animal or human. He fished a jackknife from his pocket and walked to a tall green weed upon which the red dog's greeting still clung in amber droplets. Carefully, he bent over, holding the top of the weed with his left hand while he gingerly sliced through the base, taking pains not to shake it enough to dislodge the drops. Walking as if he was stepping on eggs, he carried it up behind Fat Gurvin. Most of the men were watching Huey in quiet fascination, but they did not give him away. He bent and shook the weed, managing to splatter a goodly amount of the dog's scent on the lower part of Fat's left trouser leg, at about ankle level. Fat was so busy talking that he never noticed. He might have wondered why Alvin Laudermilk so suddenly turned around and covered his face, or why the dour Dutchman Schneider smiled. But he never let it interfere with the point he was making, that most of the progress in this country resulted from the selfless generosity of a noble bank. That had been the extent of the prank insofar as Huey had envisioned it. In his own quiet way, he'd made a statement about Fat without Fat even knowing about it. Huey hadn't considered the black dog. That innocent animal, which had followed Huey's strange motions with curiosity, sniffed at Fat Gervin's trousers, found there an invitation, hoisted his leg, and saluted.
What the... You goddamn dog from hell! Get the hell away, you stinking cur!
First startled, then enraged, Fat let out an oath that would have blistered the ears of the womenfolk if they'd been outside to hear. He fetched the black dog a savage kick that sent the bewildered animal flying. As the dog ran off, howling in surprise and pain, Fat tried in vain to shake the shame from his trousers. Alvin Laudermilk was doubled over, slapping his knee uncontrollably and gasping for breath. Pearson Phelps had choked on his pipe. Teamster Blue Hannigan got up and walked over to the house, leaning against it with his back turned, his shoulders bouncing. The Mexican laughed aloud, which added to Fat Gervin's rage. Turning, Fat saw Huey standing behind him, trying for Alvin Laudermilk's saintly expression of infant innocence. Fat seemed to sense that Huey might in some way be the author of his embarrassment. The suspicion deepened, and he clenched his fists. His eyes strained from their sockets. Huey blinked in bland curiosity, as if he had missed the whole thing. Old CC had missed it. His back turned. He stared now in consternation.
What's going on here, Fat?
CC looked down.
Spilled your coffee on you again, huh? I swear, boy. Sometimes you're left-handed on both sides.
He noticed then the angry way Fat was staring at Huey, trying to confirm his suspicions. CC seemed to sense that it was time they left.
Folks, we enjoyed the supper and the company. But tomorrow's another working day. Got to be at the bank on time in the morning.
He paused, studying his son-in-law, but not fathoming the reason for Fat's anger.
Some of you folks might not have heard. I've decided to spend a lot more time with my cattle, and a lot less with the banking end of the business. I've turned the responsibility of the bank over to Fat, to Frank, here. If you folks have business with the bank, he'll be the one you want to go and see. I'll be at the ranch.
He started toward the buggy, then stopped to look back for his son-in-law.
You coming, ain't you, boy?
Fat hadn't been a boy in 20 years.
Yes, sir.
Fat tore his eyes away from Huey and followed the old man. He tried to hold his trouser leg away from his boot while he climbed into the buggy. He never looked back as they rode away. Alvin Laudermilk couldn't restrain himself. Soon he was lying on the ground, beating the packed earth with his fist. His laughter was contagious. Huey, laughing with them, noticed that Walter seemed not to be sharing their mirth. He was watching the buggy disappear down the winding trail toward town, his face solemn. Cora Laudermilk came out presently and stared at her husband.
You men! There's not an ounce of shame in a carload of you. You've been telling those shady stories again, I can tell. And in the presence of a minister, shame on all of you.
Huey noticed the minister laughed as hard as any of them, except, of course, Alvin. If laughter could ever be fatal, there was no hope for Alvin Laudermilk. The minister had gained Huey's respect.
Alvin, dark's coming. Time we started for home.
The rest decided their holiday was over, too. Pearson Phelps pumped Huey's hand.
Huey, you come by the store first time you get a chance to go to town. Drummer left me a sample of cigars he wanted me to try. I'd like to see what you think of it.
You come in sometime, Huey. For you, I will save back a bottle of the best we have. No cost. A gift for the thing you did to that fat Gervin.
Julio Valdez hitched the Laudermilk team and brought the buckboard around. Alvin climbed into the seat and let Cora struggle up by herself. The school teacher's dog, at a signal, jumped into the back of the vehicle. It was smarter than the boy's dog. She turned to Huey and glanced around to see that no one else would hear.
I was looking out the window a while ago, Mr. Calloway. I saw what happened to Frank Gervin.
Huey reddened.
You wasn't meant to see that, ma'am. I'm sorry. I didn't go to offend you.
Offend me? I was tickled to death. In all my life, I never saw a more befitting gesture.
She gave him her slender hand.
Would you assist me, please?
He gave her a lift up into the buckboard seat beside Cora and Alvin. Julio took his place in the back, his short legs hanging over. The dog moved up beside him and licked his hand, knowing no prejudice. Tommy stood beside Huey, helping him watch the Laudermilk group disappear into the dusk.
Bud, you boys have got yourselves a real teacher. I bet you learn something every day.
Soon, the last of the visitors had gone. The teamsters had returned to their camp beneath the china berries. Eve called the boys to take the scraps down to the hog pen. Huey took a seat in the rawhide-bottomed chair and stared at the trail where everybody had gone. He got to chuckling again, remembering Fat Gervin. Walter seemed to read his thoughts. He pulled up another chair and sat a while in moody silence. Finally, he shook his head gently.
Looks like to me you pleased everybody but Fat.
Well, looks like. I hope he didn't hurt the boy's dog.
I don't reckon. But he could sure hurt us.
How?
You heard CC say he's all but turned the bank over to him. When we bought the French place, we'd taken out a note, putting up this farm for security. Big part of it is due this fall. The way the late rains delayed planting, we could find ourselves nubbing up against the due date before we got the money. I might have been able to reason with old CC, but now I'll have to talk to Fat Gervin instead.
I didn't know nothing about that. It was just that he was blowing so hard.
You never was one to fret much about consequences. I just hope Fat doesn't find out for sure what happened to him here.
All right, now, keep to it.
The blisters on Huey's hands had no chance to heal. He'd promised to build a surface tank to catch the water pumped by the new mill. This was a brutal, grubbing type of work he would never hire out to do for pay, unless he had one foot in the grave from a terminal case of starvation. But he would do it free of charge to fulfill a promise, or as a gesture to someone who had provided him bed and board. There was no dishonor unless a man took money for it. It was a work that demanded much from the body, but little from the brain. His mind was free to soar, to drift away to other times and other places, to people he had known, to people he might someday meet. the things he had done and things he intended someday to do. He trudged along behind two half-broken Laudermilk mules and guided the hungry jaws of a big steel Fresno, scooping out ancient layers of deep, rich soil and moving them 40 or 50 feet to dump them and form the rim of an earthen vessel that would water a growing Callaway cattle herd. The sweat flowed freely and his body sometimes ached, but it was a happy time, for in his mind he relived a thousand cheerful days he had known, unconsciously filtering out and rejecting the unpleasant. Huey never allowed himself to dwell on the darker times, for to live them once had been more than enough. While the mules struggled and the sharp blade cut down to the caliche undersurface, Huey Calloway rode Bronx and danced with pretty women and caroused with traveling companions like Snort Yarnell and Grady Welch. He raced horses with Homer Gans and the Indians. He helped Alvin Laudermilk find a forgotten hiding place and retrieve a whiskey bottle he'd all but given up for lost. The reunion had been a joyous thing to see. He followed the schoolteacher's red dog and watched Fat Gervin drown in the wake of 100 black mongrels with outsized bladders. All the bank examiners in the state of Texas unable to save him. After the third day, he lost count because time meant little to him. Days, he was by himself because Walter was busy in the fields and the boys were in school. Nights, they would sit outside after supper and talk a while, but everybody went to bed at dark because to do otherwise meant to burn the kerosene lamps, and kerosene cost money.
God gave us all the light we need. When it's gone, he means for us to rest.
The stricture was not firmly enforced because an allowance was made sometimes for cotton studying. Nobody told Eve about Fat Gervin and the dogs, so she was pleasant to Huey. Once, she even went into her meager reserve of dried fruit and made an apricot cobbler that she knew was a special favorite of his. Watching him come dragging into the house of an evening, sweat-crusted and weary, she would turn to him.
Huey, I believe there's still hope of you turning into a Christian.
Tommy kept hanging on to Huey's words as if they were gospel, prodding him to tell stories. His gullibility was no longer unlimited, however. Sometimes Cotton listened, and sometimes it didn't. When Cotton did listen, it was with a mood more of tolerance than of enjoyment. Usually he had school books to read, or books about mechanics and electricity, subjects in which Huey saw no future. Nobody ever learned to ride Bronx from reading a book, and knowing what made an engine run was no help in judging cattle.
No use me trying to counsel Cotton. He'll have to find out the error of his ways himself.
Late one evening, as Huey was taking the harness from the mules, preparing to feed them a bait of oats, he saw a horseman approaching on the wagon road. Sheriff Wes Wheeler came quickly to mind, but Huey soon saw that this was not the sheriff. This was a smaller man, bent-shouldered, riding a worn-out old black horse that couldn't have carried the sheriff's weight. The rider came by the Chinaberry Grove, found no freighters, and angled on up toward the house. Huey was standing at the front step by the time the old man got there. Walter, washing the day's dust off of his face in the outdoor washpan, dried himself on a towel and stepped out a little way to greet the visitor. The old horse eyed the towel suspiciously. Despite his age, he acted as if he could pitch or run if the towel made any untoward move. There were some horses that never quite gentled down, just as there were such men.
Howdy, Mr. Rasmussen. You just as well get down. Supper will be ready directly.
The old man sat hunched. He appeared bone-tired, reluctant to expend even the little energy it would take to get down from the saddle.
Much obliged, Walter. You don't suppose your woman will mind?
She probably would, Huey thought, but she wouldn't say anything the old man could hear. She would grit her teeth and be painfully civil. He remembered the old man now, though it had been some years since he'd last seen him, and boy Rasmussen had gone downhill a long way. His face was pinched and furrowed, the skin dark and dry as old leather. The blue of his eyes seemed almost faded out, so that the red which rimmed them was dominant. His chin almost touched his nose, for he carried his teeth in a leather pouch hung around his neck, the leather string covered by a once blue silk bandana that was faded and dirty and frayed. His hands were shriveled and splotched with liver spots. He had a smell that made the barking black dog keep its distance. Huey could only wonder how many years it had been since this old drifter had been given the name Boy. Rasmussen painfully brought his right leg over the high cantle, dragging his foot across the black's thin rump. Huey heard a popping sound, but he couldn't tell if it was from the dried leather of the ancient saddle or from the thin and roomy knees.
Walter, I don't suppose there'd be any whiskey about.
We don't keep any on the place.
Huey saw pity in his brother's eyes. Rasmussen's disappointment was plain.
It ain't that I'm a slave to it, you understand. It's just that I got the miseries tolerable bad today. There ain't a joint in my body.
But there was no use belaboring the point.
I don't suppose you'd have some baccy? Chewing or smoking, I wouldn't be particular.
Huey had a half-empty sack of the makings in his shirt pocket.
Keep it, Mr. Rasmussen.
It was Mr. out of deference to age. It made no difference how far down the ladder the old man had descended. On no account would Huey have addressed him as Boy. The old man eagerly took the sack in shaking hands and laboriously rolled a cigarette, spilling tobacco around the edges of the curled brown paper.
Many thanks.
Boy Rasmussen stared intently through eyes that did not see well anymore, except into the past.
You'd be Brother Huey, wouldn't you? Been off roaming the country, they tell me. Well, it's big old country. I seen most of it myself once. I reckon I'd go again, but this old pony here, I don't believe he can make it anymore. Them poor old feet have carried him too many miles.
Walter spotted Tommy staring curiously at the aging cowboy.
Tommy, I wish you'd take Mr. Rasmussen's horse down to the barn, unsaddle him, put him in a pen where the other horses won't bedevil him, and feed him some oats, will you?
Tommy took the patched leather reins from the old man's arthritis-cramped hands, his gaze roaming over the ragged black saddle that must date back to the trail-driving times after the big war. Huey could read the thought behind Tommy's eyes. How many wild and glorious scenes had that old saddle been a witness to, or even a participant in? Eve stood in the door, looking in dismay at this wizened old veteran. She would feed him supper, of that there was no question. But if she could help it, she would not have him in the house.
It's too hot to eat in the kitchen. Wouldn't you men like to eat outside where it's cool?
She didn't give them time to argue the point.
Walter, you can fix Mr. Rasmussen a plate and take it to him.
Rasmussen stared at Eve with a shyness that bordered on fear. It was a trait of these old bachelor drifters that they never quite understood women and were always nervous in their presence. The natural urges had been so long suppressed or diverted through the commercialized and mechanical attentions of the sporting women in town that they found it difficult to communicate on any level with the good women they encountered along the way. They put these women on a pedestal somewhere beyond the bounds of reality and made it a point to ride a long way around whenever they could. The old man probably knew perfectly well that Eve didn't want him in the house, but he was happy he didn't have to go in there because it would have been as much an ordeal for him as for her. He took his teeth out of the pouch and put them into his mouth, dust and all. The way he tore into the supper and ate a second helping when Walter refilled his plate for him told Huey it was probably the only thing he'd eaten all day. He was a chuckline rider, too old anymore to find any steady work, existing off of the kindness of others and off of grudging charity when he found no kindness. Almost nobody in this country would turn an old man away hungry, but there were some who would make him pay a price in shame and humiliation. Huey had heard old stories about Boy Rasmussen. He'd been a great cowboy in his time, pushing herds up the trail from South Texas to the railroads in Kansas and beyond to the Indian reservations in Wyoming and Montana. There'd been a time, before the years and the bottle robbed him of dependability, that he had bossed herds and been a man of substance and repute. But the years had not been benevolent. Whatever might once have been was gone now. All that remained was a shell, a lonely and pathetic remnant, a burned-out relic of another time so far behind him that even he must find it unreal when the ghosts went roaming through his mind, stirring the dead ashes of old campfires, speaking in voices long silent.
There was that time I got a wild hair in my
After vision. Supper, he began talking, his narrative wandering aimlessly through some long-ago time, touching on names no one else remembered. Huey noticed that Tommy listened intently, and even Cotton was drawn to the old man. He spoke of the agonies of that old war, and he spoke of roundups so far behind him that most of the other participants, man and beast, had long since gone back to dust. Somehow he seemed to slip away from reality then, and he was back in an earlier time. He got up from his chair.
I'd best be getting some sleep. I have to be up early in the morning to point the herd for Doan's Crossing on the Red. We have to make it to Dodge ahead of the other outfits before the buyers can fill their early needs and lower the price.
Huey watched him shuffle toward the barn. He looked worriedly at Walter.
They let that old man ride around by himself? It ain't safe for him.
He'll remember where he's at when he has to. He drifts through here a couple times a year. Got a brother down on the border that he stays with some. Got a sister up on the plains. He'll get there, whichever way he's gone.
Eve came outside, holding the screen door open even after she was on the front step, so she could retreat into the house if Boy Rasmussen was still around.
Did he finally go?
He went to the barn to sleep.
Good.
Eve turned her attention to the boys.
You'd have done better to have been studying your lessons instead of being out here listening to the crazy carrying on of a senile old man.
Folks say he was a wheel horse once.
Maybe so, but he's just a busted wheel now. You boys can learn one thing from him. You can learn what happens to people who drift through life with no purpose and no direction. Men wasting their good years seeking after the sinful pleasures of whiskey and the flesh, playing cards and consorting with fallen women.
She looked directly at Huey.
Eve, you've never seen me with no fallen women.
Thank God I've been spared that sight. But I have seen you daily with whiskey and cards. The rest is best left to the imagination.
Mama, what's consort?
She purposely didn't hear him. She kept her eyes on Huey.
If you don't change your ways, you'll wind up an old saddle bum like Boy Rasmussen.
Huey folded his arms, a gesture of defense.
I've never been a saddle bum. A bum begs something for nothing. Sure, I've been on the chuck line now and again, but I've always worked my way. Somebody feeds me or gives me a place to sleep, I always chop some wood or top off a bronc or something. I never leave anybody poor because he's taking me in.
Eve fixed him with a triumphant stare.
At your age, I don't suppose Boy Rasmussen did either.
She stood as if daring him to reply. Her point made, she retreated into the house, stopping only for her sons.
You boys get ready for bed.
Uncle Huey, what does consort mean?
Huey studied on that, looking in vain to his brother to step in with a better answer than his own.
I'll tell you someday when I'm old enough to know.
Walter got up and left. Sitting alone, Huey saw nothing left to do except go to bed, too. He walked down to the shed where he'd been rolling out his blankets at night. He decided to take them out into the open to get away from the smelly old man. To his relief, Huey heard the old man snoring and found that he had spread his thin roll outside the shed on the ground. That spared Huey from having to do it.